everyone. I'm Brandon Odo.
And I'm Brian Bowling.
And this is Critical Care Scenarios, the podcast where we use clinical cases, narrative, storytelling, and expert guests to unpack how critical care is practiced in the real world. Hey, everyone. Welcome back. It is Brandon Odo with Critical Care Scenarios. We have lightning rounds for you today, and we have a roundup grab bag episode. We did this some time ago. I walked around at SCCM Congress to get people's take on the delirious patient, and I thought it'd be fun to do again, this time remotely, virtually, to try to get the perspective of some different folks, various experts with different perspectives, different patient populations, different practices, but people that, you know, we've had on the podcast before. Some of them are other podcasters, some folks from online like Twitter. Just people who know what they're doing, but who do things differently. And the question we wanted to ask them, how do they like to sedate and analgesize a patient immediately post-intubation? You just put a tube into somebody, what are you going to do to keep them comfortable and safe? And I thought this was a particularly interesting question because we talk a lot about sedation, and it is often in the context of kind of maintenance. You know, what is in general going to be your strategy to maintain this patient over the course of their vent run? But the time immediately after intubation might be a little different. Maybe not. We'll see what everyone's take is. But this is a time where often the patient is at their sickest, which can mean shock or altered mental status or respiratory pathology. And oftentimes, just a lot of things that need to happen. Intubation is often just one thing in a panoply of stuff that has to get done, sometimes in a time-sensitive way. Maybe they need other procedures, like some lines placed or something. Maybe they need to go for scans. Maybe they're just generally in, you know, the highest point of their shock or respiratory failure, and you're trying to get them stable. So how you approach this might differ from how you approach the more stable patient. And what I especially find interesting is the way in which what you do here might set up what happens later. I mean, it's one thing to say you do something differently early on than later, which I think is true for many people. But, you know, things that you do initially tend to perpetuate themselves and may kind of create positive feedback loops. And to some extent, what you do now may be what you're going to continue to do later, or at least may inform it. So, for example, I'm always kind of supportive of, you know, SCCM's ICU liberation and, you know, A through F kind of packages and encouraging people to be on relatively light sedation and keeping them awake on the ventilator and things like that. But, you know, that's pretty tough to do early on for all the reasons that I said. Lots happening in this time. You know, maybe the patient is paralyzed post-intubation. They can't be awake for that and so on. So, you know, how do you apply that mindset to this difficult period of time? Never mind if you have certain patient populations like, I don't know, neuro patients, or you're in certain specialty settings like the transport setting. So let's hear what everyone has to say about this, and we can see kind of the spectrum of practice. You know, everyone you're going to hear from is an expert, so it's safe to say that every practice you hear about is probably a sound appropriate one, but they're going to differ. So obviously there's a range here that's okay. So where do you want to land here? You know, what makes the most sense to you? What do you value and prioritize? Let's have a listen and see. Just a reminder, if you missed out on our prior episode on it, Brian and I have just launched the Intensive Care Academy, an online video-based school for critical care. It's over at icu101.com, where you can get at right now over 50 videos designed to orient or train the new ICU APP for critical care. And there's going to be a whole lot more stuff coming out soon. There's a couple private podcasts you'll get access to and a ton more stuff. So go check that out if you haven't. Otherwise, let's get to it.
Hey guys, my name is Jason Wieland and I'm a physician assistant at Wake Med Health System in Raleigh, North Carolina. And during my role as a PA, we cover your standard NICU patient, cardiovascular critical care, cardiothoracic critical care, and neurosurgical critical care. You know, in regards to kind of our sedation analgesia post RSI, as you can imagine, there's a couple of places in the hospital that we could provide airway for. One would be our home base in the ICU. If it's more in an elective setting, we actually have an order set built into Epic that includes our vent settings, our RSI drugs, plus what we're going to use post RSI. So as a whole, our department is very good at starting, whether it's propofol, fentanyl, almost immediately after we have an airway. So that is generally our practice when we're intubating kind of in a stable setting in the intensive care unit. If we happen to have to intubate someone on the floor, whether it's during a code or someone in some type of crisis, we are also lucky enough to have pharmacy that comes to the patient's bedside. Will either mix up ACLS drugs for us, any type of drug we need. So outside of RSI, they're able to rather quickly provide us with our post-intubation propofol and fentanyl. Hope this helps.
Hi there, everyone. My name is Casey Albin. I am a neurointensivist at Emory University in Atlanta. From the neurologic patient population, or from a neurology standpoint, in neurocritical care, we are very often using racuronium as our paralytic of choice. And most of that is because it's a non-depolarizing agent. You know, our patients are enriched in conditions that cause neuromuscular weakness. You know, some of them will have myasthenia gravis or some clear contraindication to using succinylcholine, but a lot of them just have strokes and they have, you know, unilateral neuromuscular weakness, but are still at higher risk of sort of the risk of hyperkalemia with succinylcholine. So we really have to come up with a long enough sedative and analgesic approach that will get the patient through the hour plus of their paralytic time. And so I'd say almost 9 times out of 10, I am turning to a combination of propofol and fentanyl. When we think about neuro ICU patients, very frequently they are being intubated because of an intracranial pressure crisis, right? They started to herniate, and we are using intubation not really as a way to treat, you know, their hypercarbia or their hypoxia, but because they need airway support from a neurologic emergency. And so we are really sedating them as part of that treatment for an ICP crisis. And propofol is really such a wonderful agent to decrease the cerebral metabolic demand. And this can be really effective in lowering the ICP. Now, one caveat that I always teach our trainees is that, you know, we all know propofol does not have the most wonderful hemodynamic perspective or profile. And our patients who have elevated intracranial pressure, they actually need a higher MAP to support their cerebral perfusion pressure. And I'm sure everyone can kind of think back to, you know, the cerebral perfusion pressure equals the MAP minus the ICP as a rough approximation. And so for our patients who have high ICP, they need a higher MAP to maintain the same cerebral perfusion pressure. So the caveat to this is, even though propofol is wonderful in helping to decrease intracranial pressure, we do need to be mindful that if it's dropping a patient's blood pressure, that's probably counterbalancing the effect that we want it to have on cerebral perfusion pressure. And so, you know, for all of our intubations, we have levo at the bedside. A lot of our patients who are herniating have real hemodynamic instability. And if you take away that sympathetic surge and that Cushing response, their pressure falls. And it's really important for us to think off the bat, if we're going to use something that has the potential to further result in hypotension, that we need to have a pressor at the bedside. So that's sort of the neuro approach. And again, that's specifically for thinking about patients with ICP crisis in the neuro ICU. Really excited to hear what other people say.
My name is Kaylee Dayton. I am a nurse practitioner with 7 years of experience in an awake and walking ICU and 3 years of experience with other ICUs throughout the USA. I am now a consultant that trains ICU teams to master the ABCDEF bundle to become awake and walking ICUs. I am thrilled to be invited to join this conversation and would like to share the approach taken in the awake and walking ICU that I come from. It is a high acuity MS ICU that allows almost all patients to be awake and mobile on the ventilator unless there are specific contraindications. This has been the standard there for over 25 years and continued to be the practice in our high acuity COVID ICU. Episode 31 of this podcast goes into more detail about that and demonstrates the process in a case study. One of the ways awake and walking ICUs are able to have most patients free of sedation, riding on clipboards, and walking around the units is the approach taken in the pre, peri, and post-intubation process. The cultural norm in the ICU community is to automatically start continuous sedation after intubation and then start doing quick SATs once patients are completely stable, once ventilator settings are minimal, vasopressors are off, et cetera. But the goal of the ABCDF bundle is to have patients that are awake, communicative, autonomous, and mobile. And awake and walking ICU teams understand that is most feasible if we prevent delirium and ICU-acquired weakness by having them awake, communicating, and moving shortly after intubation. Otherwise, if we wait a day or a few days, now patients no longer have their cognition and coping mechanisms intact. They struggle to write or communicate their needs. They are lost in delirium and panicking. Everything is harder, more complicated, and the risks are higher. Obviously, there are times in which sedation is unavoidable, such as in cases of intracranial hypertension, status epilepticus, the inability to oxygenate with movement, such as with the severest of ARDS or cardiogenic shock. Yet otherwise, each intubation requires the question, is there an indication for sedation? And the indication must be proven prior to even initiating sedation. Now, this approach is not just about not giving sedation. It is what we do instead of running to sedation and how we may use sedation. It is seeing patients as more than a bag of physiology and involving them as much as possible in their own fight for their lives. So let's talk about pre-intubation. I know this isn't always an option as many of our patients come from the field, the ED, outside hospitals, OR, et cetera. Yet if we have a chance to talk to our patients and families before intubation, we must take those moments and prepare them. Tell it to them straight, the reason they need to be intubated and what to expect afterward. Tell them they're going to be awake after the procedure so we can keep their brain and body strong and intact to improve their chances of surviving and walking out the door to return to the normal lives they knew before. If possible, show them the endotracheal tube and the ventilator. Tell them it's going to be uncomfortable and that they're likely to cough and gag initially, but like thousands of patients before them, they will be able to acclimate to it. Tell them they won't be able to talk and ask what they would like to use for communication, pen and paper, whiteboard, cell phone. Assure them that their ability to tell us what they need is a top priority to you and to the team, and that we can and will treat their pain and anxiety. Warn them that they will be restrained initially just to prevent the instinct to pull the tube out, but the goal is to get them untied and free as soon as possible. In an ICU in which this is the normal routine for most patients, they may have already seen other intubated patients walking around by their room, waving at them from the doorway. This can really help them understand how routine this is, that patients are doing well while intubated, and that the ventilator is not a death trap, and that they are going to be informed and involved in the next steps. Such a culture also leads every member of the team, RT, RN, MD, ABP, CNA, etc., to be reinforcing this education and normalizing this process for patients and families. For the intubation process, there are some little tricks that can make a big impact. Using viscous lidocaine for lubrication of the endotracheal tube and cuff can help with the pain post-intubation. Pre-COVID, paralytics weren't a standard part of RSI in that unit. It was primarily etomidate and fentanyl. One of the benefits for me as a nurse back in 2012 is that I was already in the room cleaning up, charting, helping with the chest x-ray, et cetera. And so it was easy to be readily available when the patient emerged from those induction meds to help them acclimate to the tube. Yet once paralytics became more standard, we just shifted the process a little bit. Rocuronium was our go-to, but instead of 1 mg/kg, we would use 0.6 mg per kg as it seems to shorten the duration. Obviously, patients really need to be sedated under paralysis, so giving fentanyl pushes liberally and low dose Versed or even Ativan, like 1 to 2 milligrams, while watching for signs of awareness in the heart rate and blood pressure and giving more if needed. Now, the post-intubation period is really key. This moment can really be the crossroad for a patient, whether or not they end up sedated for the next few days to weeks, or if they get to be awake, communicating their needs, mobilized, and on a completely different trajectory for their ICU course and lives. Not to say that patients can't be rehabilitated and redirected after a few days, but it is much harder on teams and patients once delirium and ICU-acquired weakness have happened. It is important to prepare the family so they anticipate that the patient will cough and gag. Families need to know that their role is to stay calm and to help their loved one stay calm. They can help the patient communicate their needs so we can address their needs. It is imperative to have a tool for communication right there with the patient. I am amazed by how hard it is to find a clipboard in some ICUs that I visit. We need to give them access to communication promptly. We can treat their pain with fentanyl pushes for the first few hours, and of course, escalate to a low-dose drip and titrate up for Nalgo sedation. If the pain is primarily from the endotracheal tube, some teams that have subglottic suction endotracheal tubes will put liquid lidocaine from the vial and infuse it through the subglottic drain port, PRN. Another important consideration is gagging. Of course, with a foreign body in the throat, patients are going to gag, especially initially. It is really important to have the head of the bed up as high as possible. 30 and even 45 degrees is oftentimes not sufficient to help with the air hunger and gagging. Most of the gagging is from pulling the secretions deep in the back of the throat. Deep suctioning around the endotracheal tube initially causes gagging, but it can relieve it shortly after. Having patients swallow seems to help, whether it passes those secretions down or shifts the endotracheal tube around the gag reflex. I'm not totally sure why it works, but it seems to really help. The worst gagging I have witnessed are from patients that come from outside facilities that have been sedated for prolonged periods of time. It is an incredible challenge for days while they are delirious to help them acclimate to the tube that they think is a snake down their throat. Consistently, patients become pretty tube tolerant within about an hour after intubation with this approach if we hit it early on. Psychologically, this is a really difficult moment for patients. I cannot stress enough the importance of allowing them to communicate, dictate their pain management, be autonomous and empowered. Everything about being intubated on mechanical ventilation is abnormal, but we can find ways to help normalize it. Having a mirror or a cell phone camera on reverse so the patient can see what is strapped to their face and down their throat, carefully allowing them to feel it. Even letting them shift it by little centimeters if they are trustworthy to find a position that is more tolerable to them. Then letting them mobilize as soon as possible. Instead of being strapped to the bed, allowing them to sit up at the side of the bed, even get to a chair, walk around the room or the unit, all of that is normal. Walking is as innate and primitive as breathing. It helps normalize the abnormal. There are very few contraindications in which that is not possible or appropriate for patients. It is likely safer earlier on than when patients are weak and have delirium and are now impulsive and very dependent on the staff. Patients with higher ventilator settings or bariatric patients oftentimes prefer to be sitting in the chair to help them breathe better. This is a very anxiety-provoking experience, and although mobility, communication, family interaction, pain management, etc., help with anxiety, it is also important to consider anxiolytics, such as low-dose clonopin, to help address anxiety, but not mask it or to take away all of the other tools mentioned. Low-dose Precedex can be great if a RASS is +3 or +4, but we want to use Precedex to get them to a RASS of 0 to +1 so that they can still communicate, mobilize, connect with family, etc. Most patients should not be rendered comatose. All of these things help relieve discomfort, pain, panic, anxiety, which simultaneously give patients the best chance to survive and thrive. I know many will say, but my patients are different. I come from a trauma ICU. We have polysubstance abuse, etc. This process obviously requires critical thinking and customization, but it is applicable to all ICUs. For more information about this, check out the podcast, Walking Home from the ICU, in which awake and walking ICUs from all over the world and specialties share their expertise.
Hey everyone, Nick Ioni here, also known as Poem Toilet on X, and recently TikTok, as I lean into the Gen Z culture more and more heavily. To be honest, I never really thought about this and just always sort of thought that it rolled into the sedation plan for when the patient was started on the mechanical ventilator. given the fact that this procedure and mechanical ventilation are two separate things, there is that time period in between where we've just intubated the patient, right before we're about to start continuous sedation or PRN bolus of opiates or doing other things for the patient in that setting. There is that time frame where there is a specific approach to maybe sedation and things we may do differently that I hadn't really thought about up until this point. And I'd like to give you sort of my personal approach. So the one thing I think that is really important is avoiding or minimizing post-intubation awareness of paralysis. This had recently come up in some peer-reviewed literature that a certain percentage of patients would have awareness of their paralysis, which has to be a terrifying experience and certainly would contribute to the morbidity of an ICU stay. So preventing this, I think, is paramount. And the way that I do this is I definitely like to give a bolus of midazolam in either the pre, intra, or post-intubation period. Secondly, I think using PRN bolus of medications is important and a strategy that I often employ. What I mean by that is before we're sort of setting up the drips and the sedation or maybe doing other things for the patient. Maybe the patient needs a central line or needs an arterial line or their Foley needs to be placed or whatever the case may be. In that immediate post-intubation period, I like to think that we would like to have more control over the situation, given that the patient who was just intubated probably has some ongoing issue that we need to sort of take more control over. Now, after this period, I am a huge proponent and build it into the daily rounds and think it's best practice to limit sedation when you can and target RAS goals that are somewhere closer to zero if the patient's able to tolerate that in their disease state. But in that post-intubation period where we might need to do other things for the patient that require them to be not overly awake or be more sort of compliant with what we're doing, whether it's a procedure or with the ventilator settings that we are starting for that patient, then I think using PRN bolus medications is helpful. Like I said earlier, I do like to give a bolus dose of midazolam. I like to give bolus doses of fentanyl to sort of get control if I think the patient's either becoming endangered to themselves, maybe in a breathing sense. So if we intubate the patient for respiratory distress and possible ARDS, in that post-intubation period, once the paralysis wears off, I wouldn't want the patient going back to breathing very aggressively or breathing over the ventilator settings that might be set for lung protection. So bolus doses of either opiates or benzos or even propofol in this setting. Sometimes I like to give a bolus dose of propofol, knowing that it's, you know, not hemodynamically neutral. So that's always in the back of my mind, but giving a bolus dose of 2 to 5 mL, which turns out to be 20 to 50 milligrams of propofol, I think is a quick way to get a patient calmer if the situation calls for it. Then once we sort of pass that time frame of the post-intubation, sort of the very immediate post-intubation period, I usually like to set patients up on what the SCCM is a proponent of, which is analgesia first sedation, meaning we try to attain our RAS goal by using push dose opiate in an attempt to limit continuous sedative medication. Some patients tolerate this incredibly well. Unfortunately, with the pandemic, we got away from that for a lot of different reasons. I think initially it was because of PE shortage. It was difficult to have nursing go into the room every 1 to 2 hours to administer medication. So we sort of reverted back to a opiate infusion strategy, which I think is not ideal for most patients. I realize there are some situations where that might be a better choice, but overall, I think bolus dose opiate responding to either a RAS or pain goal is really the way to go and the way to limit sedation and set the patient up for a successful SAT and SBT. But in the initial time period post-intubation, once we get the patient through that initial part of their ventilator journey, I do like to start with push dose opiates, namely fentanyl, 50 to 100 micrograms of fentanyl every 1 to 2 hours for a pain or a RAS goal. Afterward, I like to and find the most success with reaching for propofol first as my sedative, understanding that there is some hemodynamic impact and it's not perfect. But for a RAS goal, for a sedative, I think propofol works better than dexmedetomidine. And I think this is certainly borne out more or less in the literature, or certainly there's no difference as far as the literature goes. A 2019 trial, SPICE 3, and then the recent A2B trial that I think still needs to come out further elucidates this point. I realize that I haven't said anything about the medication that seems to be the darling of everyone recently, which is ketamine. And this is because, to be honest, I haven't used a lot of ketamine recently, which is due to the fact that I practice in a mostly medical ICU and the 50 milligram syringes have been harder to come by according to the pharmacists that I work with, given some manufacturing constraints. But in recent times, in the past 6 to 12 months, we've been able to stock them more consistently. So I think I'll probably roll that into my practice in the upcoming months to years.
Hi, my name is Jace Mullen and I'm a flight paramedic. When planning post-intubation sedation, I kind of use two tools. The first is that I always like to brief my post-intubation sedation plan while I'm calling for my meds for intubation. So me and my partner will either have already briefed what our plan is or we'll be coming up with our plan while we're talking about our initial meds. The other thing I like to do, though, is I like to verbalize a cognitive checkpoint for post-intubation sedation. What this usually means is I'll verbalize to the room, whoever is there, something like, we'll give our sedation by the time we get them on the vent. What this allows is for our new friends in the back of the ambulance or the ER or whoever is helping us with this intubation to help backstop me and my partner in case we get task saturated and have them feel like they're able to say something and say, hey, weren't you going to give them the meds once you got on the vent? That helps us a lot. As for actual strategy, I basically virtually always use ketamine for induction unless it's one of the very rare contraindicated patients. And because of this, there's always a vial already out and floating around either my hands or my partner's hands. So that's usually my first port of call for post-intubation sedation. Just logistically, it's easier for us and it's reliable. It does analgesia and sedation. It's a great option, I think, for this. And I'll do a dissociative dose initially right off the bat. After the initial dose, I'll work to tailor a sedation plan using some combination of bolus dosing of opioids, benzos, ketamine, or depending on the transport time, I might be initiating a drip-based dosing of fentanyl, ketamine, probe, kind of your standard stuff. I am lucky, though, that in my world, there's very little of what I describe as like resuscitative friction. By this, I mean that there's very few steps between me or my partner making a decision or we're making a decision together regarding med administration or a procedure and being able to actually do that thing. So between us being able to like, hey, we want to give some more meds, but actually pushing that med into an IV might be 5 to 30 seconds, depending on what's actually going on. This, coupled with the fact that me and my partner never have more than one patient together, allows us to kind of tailor sedation strategies a little more closely using things like bolus dose meds. If we're using bolus dose strategies, though, I do need to be mindful that while we have a very low friction and we can kind of do things as quickly and easily, the ER, ICU, or whoever we're dropping this patient off to might not be as facile or able to do that. And so I want to make sure that I'm not setting them up for failure by being a patient that's going to be rapidly metabolizing the meds that I gave them right after I transfer care and maybe putting them behind the eight ball.
My name's Emily Friedenmaker. I'm a pulmonary and critical care attending in West Virginia, and I take care of MICU patients pretty much exclusively. Every now and then, I'll cover surgical patients, but not very often. When I intubate somebody, I usually use ROCK, so I'm planning for them to be paralyzed for at least half an hour. And to be safe in my head, I usually extend that time frame to about an hour that I'm planning for deeper sedation than I usually would use. As part of my pre-intubation checklist, I ask somebody to hang propofol so that it can be ready to go as soon as the intubation is done. And I have them infuse it at least a moderate dose, if not higher. And I have a low threshold to use like PRN fentanyl if there's any concern for pain or anything prior to intubation. I have occasionally used a PRN Versed if the patient was very awake or agitated prior to the intubation on, you know, max Presidex or something like that, just if the clinical scenario made me worried that the patient would not be deeply sedated enough until the propofol took effect, but that's not usually something that I have to use. And then as soon as the patient's moving around again or at an hour, if they're too deep to really wake up at all, I ask the nurse to start quickly weaning the sedation until we find the lowest that we need to achieve our RAS goal.
Well, there you go, guys. I think that was a really interesting spectrum of different takes on this. You could see how much range and variation in practice there is, you know, between just differences in personality or training, local culture or setting, differences in practice population specialty, such as Casey's neuro patients, to, you know, how much you prioritize and have the toolkit to place a priority on things like, you know, ICU liberation and minimizing the sequela of sedation and mechanical ventilation. And I mean, that's kind of where I often lean. But what I loved about Kaylee's portion here is how much she really emphasized the tools you need to do that effectively. It's not just a matter of saying, well, you know, when you put patients on the ventilator, try not to sedate them much and, you know, move them around and keep them awake and stuff like that. But to actually do that effectively requires you to know what to do kind of instead of just knocking patients out and letting them lie there. And of course, she got into some of that. You know, I've never seen some practices like using lidocaine jelly on your ET tubes or pumping lidocaine into a supraglottic suction port to minimize gagging, that sort of thing. But of course, things like keeping patients sitting upright is something that we could all do. So hopefully you guys can all take something away from this. On one hand, that there is so much variation and therefore, you know, what you're doing is probably okay, but also that there is room to probably improve and really, I guess, to target and tailor your practices towards the kind of goals you want to achieve. And hopefully you got some sense of that today. There may not be one right or wrong way, but if there's certain things that you want to pull off and really manifest with this patient's course of mechanical ventilation, then that's going to start right away with what you give them right after intubation. And in many ways, that's going to set the stage and kind of perpetuate itself later. Of course, you can always change things, but like a lot of critical illness, changing things is always harder than starting off on the right foot to begin with. Hopefully that's helpful. Check out Intensive Care Academy if you haven't yet, ICU101.com. We'll talk to you next time.